Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording January 14th, 2020, we're going to be discussing recent events in the Middle East between Iran and the United States with our fellow Thomas Junot. Thomas, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thanks for having me.
So this issue has gotten extensive coverage both in Canada and around the world, but that's not always good coverage that helps us understand the situation. So why don't you start the conversation off today by giving us what you think is the important context that Canadian listeners should know that would help us understand how we got to the events that have unfolded in the last couple of weeks?
So very quickly, for the last 40 years, as we all know, the U.S. and the Islamic Republic of Iran have been rivals. They've been enemies. There have been ups and downs in that rivalry over the decades. Under the Obama administration, especially in the last couple of years, that tension was not gone, but it was maybe a bit better managed, including with the nuclear deal. President Trump comes in about 3 years ago and starts ramping up the rhetoric on Iran. In 2018, President Trump withdraws from the nuclear deal, and basically ever since then, about a year and a half ago, we've been seeing tension between the U.S. and Iran with some ebbs and flows, but overall on an upward trend. Throughout the fall of 2019, that tension was increasingly high. The idea, by December 2019, that 2020 would really see some difficult moments between the U.S. and Iran was something that pretty much everybody agreed on. Then just after Christmas, Iran, or to be more precise, the Shia militias in Iraq that are supported by Iran attack an American base in Iraq and kill an American contractor. And that was the key moment in launching us towards where we are now, because President Trump had been quite clear in the last few months that killing American citizens was a red line. The U.S. retaliates a few days after that, very late December, by killing several dozen Iraqi Shia militiamen supported by Iran, as well as Iranian personnel. Iran retaliates a few days later, we're at the very end of 2019 by now, encouraging its Shia militia proxies in Iraq to attack the American embassy. And then, as we all know, the U.S. retaliates in very early January of this year by killing General Soleimani, who was the head of external operations and special forces for the Revolutionary Guards. So in a nutshell, that's how we got to where we are.
So to expand a little bit, if you could you give us a sense of, so if you're thinking from a Western Canadian or more familiar with the American context, how would you kind of describe the Iranian general's role in terms of Westerners could relate to? So who would the equivalent position be in, say, the American military establishment or the Canadian one, just to help us situate who exactly he was and what role he played?
The Iranian system is very different. It's impossible to identify one equivalent in either the American or Canadian system. The position that General Soleimani had was in many ways a mix of special forces, intelligence, and diplomacy. But to say that he fused all three of these jobs would not be accurate, because there are other very important individuals in the Iranian system still doing some of these functions. So General Soleimani's main function was to mobilize, equip, advise, and in some cases help command militias, armed non-state actors throughout the region, in Lebanon, Hezbollah, in Iraq, as we've seen in recent days, in Yemen, the Houthis, and in other parts of the region, in Syria too. And so his role in supporting these militias and mobilizing them and advising them, providing them with weapons, with cash, with intelligence, with military advice, was extremely important. So there was a big intelligence role at that level, a big special forces role, a big training component, but also a big diplomatic component, which is something that we have seen in the media quite a bit in recent days when referring to him. You know, he was not the Minister of Foreign Affairs, but in terms of Iranian foreign policy in the region, especially in Iraq and Syria, he was far more influential than the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs. So his death is a big loss for Iran. That's undeniable. That being said, one thing that has to be kept in mind is that, you know, the Iranian government as a whole has very strong institutions that are not dependent on only one individual. So as much as his contacts, his skill, his military genius is gone, and that is a loss for Iran, the institution of the Quds Force, the special forces that he commanded, it absolutely survives. There's a new commander that was named within about 12 hours, who was his number two, who may not be as skilled as him, but will be able to continue his mission.
And so setting aside kind of the formal roles and responsibilities and his actual capabilities, how would you assess how he registered in the public consciousness or elite consciousness in Iranian society? Was he somebody that's quite well known and highly valued, or how would you kind of put a qualitative flavor rid of that?
So that's a very difficult question to answer, and one that's been quite controversial among Iran specialists in the last few days. So General Soleimani was very well known in Iran. He was often viewed, and this is a tricky thing to say, but he was often viewed as one of the most popular figures inside Iran. He was viewed by many as a bit of a nationalist hero. That has to be nuanced. For a lot of Iranians, he was also, at the same time, a key figure in the extremely brutal repressive apparatus of the Islamic Republic. But these things are not completely mutually exclusive in the sense that for a lot of Iranians, even those who are not sympathetic to the Islamic Republic, and there are a lot of them, there was some respect, sometimes grudging, but sometimes very overt, for what he had done in terms of Iranian influence abroad. So this issue of Soleimani's support inside of Iran is a very complicated one that has both positive and negative aspects to the answer. So, you know, his death triggered, in many cases, real protests in Iran that were not protests in support of the government of the Islamic Republic, of the system of the Islamic Republic, but just nationalist protests at the killing of an important individual by the United States. But it's really important to emphasize that these protests, which were real, were not to be confused with actual support for the Islamic Republic.
Okay. And then, so the other piece I want to get to before getting to some of the other bits that unfolded was that General Soleimani wasn't traveling alone. So can you talk a little bit about who he was with and who else was killed in that American drone strike?
That is a very important question, and one that with all the spectacular aspects of General Soleimani's killing, it's an important question that got neglected. So we do know that Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was one of the most senior commanders in pro-Iran Shia militias in Iraq, was killed, and some of his aides were also killed. This is extremely important because, yes, this weakens to some extent Iraqi Shia militias, but there's a desire of vengeance on that side too. So there's been a lot of talk of Iranian retaliation against the U.S. in the wake of General Soleimani's killing. That is not over, right? The missile attack of a few days ago was not the last part of that. But one thing that we will have to monitor very closely in the next days and weeks and months is the desire on the side of Iraqi Shia militias to avenge the death of one of their most senior commanders. For now, it appears that they have been asked by Iran to refrain from retaliating, to really tone down tensions between Iran and the U.S., and it appears that Iran has succeeded in making sure that that happens. But in the midterm, that will be a very important thing to follow.
So two pieces of follow-on from that. The first is, how significant is the role of those militias that you're just describing in Iraq right now or the wider region? And then talk a little bit about the linkage between, so how tight was the linkage between them and Iran? I guess one of the things that really struck me as not an expert at all in Middle East politics was that the General Soleimani was traveling, I guess maybe not out in the open, but certainly didn't seem to be traveling all that clandestinely, flying into the airport, coming out of it. The reporting doesn't really suggest that he was in all that heavily armored of a convoy or those types of things. Am I misinterpreting that, or is he comfortable enough traveling in the country that he was doing so relatively out in the open? And what does that say about both the linkages between Iran and those militias and the role of the militias specifically in the country and the wider area?
So I'll answer the second part of your question on General Soleimani traveling like that, and then I'll talk more broadly about Iraqi Shia militia supported by Iran. That's an interesting point. In a way, that has to be seen as a failure of operational security on the part of General Soleimani and his entourage. That being said, if you take a few steps back, as of 2 weeks ago, that would have seemed pretty normal. General Soleimani was traveling to Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon in particular on a very regular basis, posting selfies of himself on Facebook and other social media. There was a bit of a cult of his own personality that he was cultivating quite actively. He believed that he was untouchable. He believed that the U.S. would not attack him in the open. Media reports have shown that the U.S. under both Bush and Obama had considered assassinating him and had decided not to do it for fear of reprisals and destabilization. So that probably emboldened him, and at some point probably led to a bit of hubris. He believed that in parts of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, he was safe, and that groups that he and Iran supported would make sure that he would not be in danger. In the end, that was a complete miscalculation. As to the other part of your question on pro-Iran Shia militias in Iraq, there are several tens of thousands of troops that fall under that very broad label. One important point to keep in mind is that this is an extremely heterogeneous, but is not a monolith. Of those tens of thousands of pro-Iran or generally speaking, Iraqi Shia militias, there's a continuum, right? It's not monolithic. Some of them are actual Iranian proxies in the narrow definition of the proxy term, i.e. they obey Iranian commands to a large extent. You know, they act at Iran's behest. At the other extreme, you have Iraqi Shia militias that receive little or no support from Iran and certainly are not proxies in the sense that they do not obey orders from Iran. They are not arms of Iranian foreign policy. And then you've got everything in between. You have Iraqi Shia militias, units within Iraqi Shia militias. Iran is very surgical in terms of who it supports and how. And so all of these in the middle, they work with Iran. They have shared interests with Iran. They receive some support from Iran, weapons, cash, intelligence, advice. But Iran is not the only source of their support. And, you know, to say that they are arms of Iranian foreign policy is inaccurate. It's a simplification in their case. They will work with Iran when it suits them, but when it doesn't, they will do their own thing. So, that broad spectrum of Iraqi Shia militias is extremely diverse. And the extent of Iran's relations with all of them changes a lot. It is very pragmatic, both on the Iranian side, but also on the Iraqi side. In theory, all of these militias are under the command of the Iraqi government. In practice, it is extremely varied, the extent of command and control that central Iraqi authorities have over them.
And so just as a bit of a segue to the conversation I want to have in more detail about Canada's role in the region, we are there, and in one of the capacities that we're there, we're through the NATO mission, training one element of the, I guess it's the formal Iraqi national security forces that we're working with. How big percentage, I guess in rough terms, so if you're thinking about Iraq and the different armed elements that their government, as you said, at least on paper, has a degree of control over, what sort of the rough apportionment and percentage of those that are the quote-unquote official Iraqi National Army, what share of those are the militias? And I guess I would assume that there's a big degree of regional variability in terms of the different proportions based on the part of the country. So paint a bit of a picture about how influential the different actors, those groups you were talking about, are in different parts of Iraq.
So in terms of giving a number on the proportions that you asked, I don't know that number, and I've never seen a number like that in public information, in the sense that it really depends on how you define the extent of Iranian control, which, as I said, is extremely varied. So different people would give you a different answer. One key point to have in mind here is that Canada, even though there is relatively little information in the public domain in terms of who we support, the government officials have said on a number of occasions publicly that the units within the Iraqi military that the Canadian forces support as part of the NATO training mission or as part of the non-NATO aspect of the international presence in Iraq are not those units supported by Iran, right? They are the, as you said, the conventional or the central Iraqi security forces that are fully under the authority of the Ministry of Defense and more broadly, the Iraqi government. And Canada is very careful about that. That being said, there is relatively little detail beyond that general point that is available publicly.
Okay. So let's switch gears a little bit. So you have the American strike, and then you had the Iranian response firing. Reports kind of vary, but several missiles, I guess a particular type is up for some discussion, but going into two different coalition or American bases, one not that far from Baghdad and the other one close to Erbil. One of the things I was struck by in watching the coverage, including comments that you made about that there was a degree of surprise that the Iranians responded directly and themselves rather than through proxies to the drone strike. So I guess talk a little bit about that and what that would say about the Iranian response and then how this is influencing the conditions and unfolding events in the region.
So that's a key point because this is the first time that the Iranian military directly and openly attacks American assets in the Middle East. Indirect attacks have happened multiple times. We've stopped counting during the occupation of Iraq from 2003 to 2011 and since the U.S. went back to Iraq after 2014. But they have always been indirect, as you said, through proxies. So in most cases, Iraqi Shia militias supported by Iran have attacked U.S. assets. That's happened on a number of occasions. In this case, the latest number I've seen is 22 Iranian missiles on the two American bases. I'm not sure how 100% true that is, but that seems to be what we're working with right now. Iran admitted that it shot these missiles itself. And that's a first, because usually it tried to have various degrees of plausible or less plausible deniability in terms of attacks on American assets. In this case, I think the reason for that is quite clear. It's a message to the U.S. that, well, you killed one of our most senior officials. Our response, even though Iran very clearly refrained from killing American personnel in sending these missiles, at least by openly saying we sent them, there's a message there. And part of that message is, if there is escalation, we will send missiles again on your bases. So that's a fairly clear message on the Iranian side. And in the end, what we saw, you know, within hours after that missile attack last week was a clear willingness to de-escalate on both sides.
So just to follow up on one of the things that you had just said there, you said that in your opinion, they clearly refrained from killing American personnel. Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because I was struck that irrespective of how it was that the Iranian missiles did not kill coalition forces, it either shows a quite high degree of precision targeting ability and reliability of their ordnance, or a fairly significant degree of risk acceptance on the part of the Iranians to take the chance that any number of things that could go wrong if you're firing off that number of missiles wouldn't.
So that's a key point. And there's still a bit of debate on that. And I have to, you know, recognize that there's not 100% consensus on this. But my working theory as of now is that Iran did not want to kill American personnel in its retaliation for the killing of General Soleimani, because it feared, probably rightly, that killing American personnel in its retaliation would lead to another American retaliation and an escalation, or at least the risk of an escalation. And the Islamic Republic understands very well, they've been doing this for 40 years, that in a scenario of open direct military confrontation with the U.S., they lose, because in terms of conventional military power, they are vastly inferior to the U.S. They can inflict damage to the U.S. They can actually inflict quite a bit of damage to the U.S., but they cannot defeat the U.S., whereas the U.S. can defeat them. The U.S., because of its massive military superiority, can seriously hurt the Islamic Republic. Remember that the fighting here happens in Iraq and potentially in Iran, 12,000 kilometers away from the U.S., right? There's that comfort of distance that the U.S. has that Iran does not have. So the working theory here is that Iran had to do something. It had to retaliate to send a regional message, to send a message to the U.S., to send a message to its own population too, but at the same time did not want to kill American personnel. It apparently sent messages to the U.S., we will attack some of your bases. How precise that messaging was is not clear, probably through Iraqi intermediaries, but again, there are certainly some parts of this that we do not know publicly. And then missiles were sent on these bases, not killing anyone. I think that was on purpose. As you said, however, there are two elements here that are extremely important. First, significant risk, right? Because if this had not worked for whatever reason, missile malfunction, American personnel who are not hidden at the right places or whatever, there would have been a risk of escalation. So clearly, yes, a significant risk that Iran took in doing this. Number two is precision. And here you are right to mention that. You know, 10 years ago, I would have said Iran is never going to do this because its missiles were not precise enough. Now its short-range missiles, or this was a relatively small distance, are probably accurate and reliable enough for Iran to do this with some degree of confidence. Not 100% confidence, and there was a risk. Its longer-range missiles to reach farther in the region would have a far lower degree of reliability and accuracy. But at a short distance like this, it was plausible for Iran to make this calculus.
You're listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries. One other question on this that strikes me, is there anything significant that you read into the selection of the two bases? One whose name I won't even try and pronounce because I'll completely mangle it, close to Baghdad, I guess is one of the most significant regional locations the Americans are working out of. So there's a logic to that. What about the selection of the base in Erbil?
That's hard to say. And at this point, that would be only speculation in answering that because we don't really know. These are large bases. These are prominent bases. In the case of the Ayn al-Assad base close to Baghdad, part of the logic may be that there were weapons depots there. Have been some reports in Iranian media, perhaps to try to compensate, if you will, for the fact that they didn't kill American personnel, that they did target weapons, American weapons at that base. How true that is, it's not completely clear at this point. The Erbil base, I think there might have been a message on the Iranian side also to show their reach, to demonstrate that they were able to hit more than one base at the same time. But a lot of this at this point remains speculation.
Okay, so let's focus a little bit more specifically on what this means for Canada. So I think as one of the national columnists was pointing out, I think a lot of Canadians were going to be surprised to learn just how many people we still had working in Iraq specifically and in the region more broadly. So the official numbers are something like up to 500 personnel in Iraq specifically, and then another couple of hundred in the wider region as part of the wider set of operations there that gets us close to something like 800 or 850 as the upper limit. What do you think this exchange, and of course we haven't even really talked about the tragic plane incident, just still unfolding, but to me that's almost kind of a separate action related to, obviously, but not as narrowly linked to the military operation. What does all of this mean for Canada's military presence in the region ongoing? How viable is it? How much do you think that the intent of what we were trying to do there is still achievable? What does this mean for Canada's military presence?
It's still very early days, so hard to say. But as the dust slowly settles, I am seeing the emergence of a most likely scenario, but keeping in mind that A, it is not the only scenario, and B, there have been multiple surprises in the last couple of weeks that could easily throw off this balance of probabilities. But what seems to me, keeping these caveats in mind, to be emerging as the most likely scenario is continuation of the status quo in a very uneasy way. Iran and the U.S. have shown that they want to de-escalate. Tensions are not over. Nothing has been solved in the fundamental dispute between Iran and the U.S. There will be other peaks in tension, but there were peaks in tension last year when the mission was ongoing. So, you know, we were in Iraq, about 500 troops, 800 total in the region. The bulk of their focus was training Iraqi and other regional security forces to help them in the fight against the Islamic State. That remains necessary. And if anything, right now, one of the few winners of what's been going on for the last 3 weeks is precisely the Islamic State, which has shown over the years that one of its most important skills is to step in when chaos increases, when a vacuum is formed. So there is a priority now for Canada, keeping in mind that we are not the decision maker on this, but for Canada and the U.S. and other allies to resume, when possible, the mission against the Islamic State. So if indeed the de-escalation between Iran and the U.S. is confirmed, keeping in mind that tension will remain high, if the dust settles in that direction, then I think there will be a willingness on the part of everybody involved to try to resume that mission, possibly with more constraints and being more careful, getting out of bases less, circulating openly in Iraq and elsewhere in the region maybe a bit less, and things like that to play it a bit safer. But I think everybody agrees that these efforts need to continue. Is that the only scenario? No, not at all. Could there be a decision at NATO or elsewhere to actually withdraw partially or completely some of these efforts because of these high tensions? Perhaps some allies are going to do that, but that would be a very risky decision, not only because it would weaken the effort against the Islamic State, but potentially could have a cost in terms of relations with the U.S.
So I think some of the force protection considerations you're talking about there in terms of how you provide for the safety of personnel, I guess to my mind, both the fact that you said that there's been some multiple surprises in terms of the decision-making on both the American and the Iranian side, as well as the fact that the Iranians just demonstrated at a minimum a high degree of risk acceptance in the response with the missile attacks, I would think would have a lot of the senior decision-makers in Canada's attention. One thing that I was interested in your thoughts on was the Iraqi views about our continued presence. So there was a vote. I don't pretend to fully understand the mechanics of what that meant, but what's your read on where the Iraqi national sentiment is for continued American / Western / NATO / Canadian presence in the country? Because that to me seems to be pretty fundamental to us continuing to be there and provide the type of assistance that you were describing that we've been doing that's been of value.
So that is a key variable in trying to think about scenarios moving forward. Canada and NATO and the US and other allies are in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government, right? That's what makes this mission legal. We are invited by the Iraqi government. If the Iraqi government withdraws that invitation, then the legality of the mission and its legitimacy disappears. So the million-dollar question, obviously looking forward, is will that invitation be withdrawn? That is not so sure. There is a lot of noise in Iraqi politics. A lot of politicians, especially on the Shia side, especially on the pro-Iran side, are asking for the U.S. to leave. That is, it is conceivable that that could happen, but I still do see that as far from guaranteed. And there are, at a minimum, multiple steps that have to happen before we reach the point of the withdrawal of the invitation. First of all, there are a lot of Iraqi politicians who don't want the U.S. and the international presence to leave, especially on the Sunni and Kurdish side, because partly they see the American and international presence as a bulwark against domination of Iraq by Iran and its local Shia partners. Even on the Shia side, it is not unanimous that the U.S. should leave. There are some who will make not a lot of noise about it because there are few political points to be won in Iraq. Remember, it's a democracy, by standing up in favor of the American presence. But when push comes to shove, not all Shia politicians will vote in favor of the U.S. leaving, or it's not guaranteed that they will. So, you know, that there's a lot of moving parts on the parliamentary side, on the domestic political side in Iraq, that makes this very uncertain. But, support for the U.S. leaving is far from 100%. The other thing is that there are multiple uncertainties that just add to that. We can't go through all of them, but one of them worth mentioning is the status of the prime minister. The Iraqi prime minister resigned. He's staying on as a caretaker prime minister, and it's not clear if he actually has the authority to sign a bill voted by parliament if it comes to that, which, as I just said, is not guaranteed, it's not clear that he actually has the authority to sign that bill, asking the Americans to leave as a caretaker prime minister. Iraq is a young, very fragile democracy, so we actually don't even know what the answer to that is. We could go on and on, but all of that taken together means that for now, the Americans are staying in Iraq, and we have not reached the point where they are asked to leave. If they are asked to leave eventually, then of course it's the end for Canada, because Canada and others cannot stay without the American presence. That's completely clear.
With the discussion around Iraq, our troops are temporarily relocated to Kuwait. Do you think, is the sentiment in Iraq that you're sort of describing the complexity of that, do you see echoes of that in other Gulf states and in the area surrounding us? Because a lot of the other forces that are supporting operations in Iraq are based elsewhere, in Kuwait, in Qatar, and in surrounding areas. Do you have a sense that there's any change, in, or at least an opening in the official or public sentiment about presence of Western and American forces specifically in those areas?
I don't see much of a change. You know, the Gulf states led by Saudi Arabia and the other smaller ones, the UAE and Kuwait, they are sitting tight right now. They're very concerned. As much as some of them, especially Saudi Arabia, have taken a very harsh line against Iran over the years, Saudi Arabia did more so under Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, as we know in Canada, they ultimately don't actually want a war with Iran. And that's an important point to keep in mind. They want the U.S. to sanction Iran. They want the U.S. to isolate Iran. They want the U.S. to contain Iran. But if in a scenario of open warfare, they are on the front lines and they pay the price because they know, especially Saudi Arabia, that retaliation is highly likely to come on them. So right now, they support efforts to de-escalate. They support efforts to manage these tensions a bit better. If that means a bit more of an American or other Western presence in the region, you mentioned Kuwait, for now, they're fine with that. And in the case of Kuwait, they understand that it's to some extent temporary.
One other overlying feature of this particular series of events is that Canada is without diplomatic representation with Iran for a number of years now. What impact do you think that is having? And does this point, in your opinion, to the need to reestablish that? And is that likely?
So multiple levels to that question. Canada has not had diplomatic relations with Iran since 2012 under the Conservative government when embassies were closed. The Liberals tried in the previous 4 years to reopen embassies. They were not able to do so, largely as a result of hurdles established by the Conservatives. As much as I was on the side of the debate in support of reestablishing relations with Iran, I would always say, but ultimately, it's not a big deal in the sense that Iran is not a big priority for Canada. Now it is. And now not having an embassy on the ground hurts. It hurts Canadian interests. It hurts our ability to manage the fallout of the downing of the Ukrainian airliner a few days ago. So now we see why that was a bad decision. It makes consular efforts more difficult. It makes contacts with the Iranian government more difficult. It makes information gathering more difficult to get a good sense on the ground of what's going on. And that list could go on. Can that be changed? In the short term, it changed a bit in the sense that now we have a team of about 10 officials in Iran. That's better than nothing. That's not quite the same as an embassy, but it helps. The Iranians, you know, granted them visas and now are allowing them to do minimal work, though obviously not in a fully transparent way. Can diplomatic relations be reestablished? Can we use the current crisis to try to change that? Maybe. And obviously, we don't know what discussions Canada and Iran have had at that level in the last week or so. Presumably now they're focusing on managing the current crisis. Can it serve as a launchpad to try to reestablish relations? Perhaps some of the obstacles have been raised. Some consular cases have been resolved, and not all of them, but some. But the hurdles established by the Conservatives that prevented the Liberals from reopening embassies are still there. Some of the sanctions are still there. So it will be difficult in the best of cases.
If I'm correct on this, I think it was the Prime Minister Trudeau spoke with the Iranian president, wasn't it, in the last couple of days?
Yes, he did.
And do you read anything into that? I mean, that seems to me to be something that's fairly out of the ordinary.
It is out of the ordinary because I'm not aware that it happened under the first Trudeau government from 2015 to 19. Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Stéphane Dion and then Chrystia Freeland, had a number of discussions on the phone and in person, notably at the UN, to try to discuss both reopening embassies and resolving consular cases. But I'm not aware that there were discussions from prime minister to president. So is it significant? Yes, it is, in the sense that it hadn't happened for a long time. That being said, I think it has to be seen not as a sign of reopening embassies, but more as a pledge on both sides that they will continue talking in terms of managing the current crisis. You know, the Iranian government, you can see the glass as, you know, not even half full, but with, you know, say 25% water in the last few days, in the sense that they have granted visas, they have granted some access, they have been cooperating more than the more cynical among us would have expected a few days ago. That being said, the glass is still easily 75% empty, in the sense that, you know, the transparency and accountability and cooperation on the Iranian side is still very limited.
And do you see that transparency and cooperation changing any? Because in my looking at this, it seems that whatever happened with that aircraft, and it seems that, you know, the general consensus, I guess, seems to be shifting to some kind of discussion about the degree of intentionality or not in the missile firing that ultimately led to it coming down. But that's ultimately seems to be quite intertwined with the Iranian air defense network and system. If I was Iranian, given the ongoing disputes back and forth, I would be in no rush to have anybody poking around into the operational procedures that are being used.
There's no doubt in my mind that, giving access to the site, for example, as soon as you get into the more military side of things, the more operational side of things, then no, Iranian cooperation will be at most extremely limited and possibly even less than that, especially once you get into their air defenses and so one. The Iranians will not be interested in sharing information at this level.
Okay. So final high-level comment. What do you think are the key variables to watch from a Canadian point of view in the next few months?
In the next few days, the level of cooperation on the Iranian side, there is some, but it is very limited. So of that limited cooperation and sharing of information and transparency, what will Canada be able to get out of it in terms of helping families, repatriate bodies, and so on? That's the immediate priority. Beyond the consular dimension of that, figuring out what exactly happened. There, I think limits will be even lower on the Iranian cooperation side. Beyond that, after weeks and months, looking at what this means for Canada-Iran relations, is this going to serve as an opening for Canada and Iran to try to reopen embassies? Definitely something to watch too. I think it could go either ways. I'm not optimistic, but there might be an opening.
So the last question, what are you reading these days?
So over the weekend, once the kids were in bed, I did take back out a book called Vanguard of the Imam by Afshan Ostovar, which is probably the best book on the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. I had read that book 1 or 2 years ago, but just to remind myself a bit of some of the amazing analysis and insight in that book on the Revolutionary Guard. Beyond Iran, last night I started a book called Energy Kingdoms by Jim Crane, which is a fairly recent book on, you know, oil and politics in the Persian Gulf, on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf, which is a book that's been very well reviewed. And on the fiction side, and there is a bit of a link, there is an Algerian author called Yasmina Khatra, which is a pseudonym, who was an Algerian military officer who was writing anonymously and then fled to France and has written by now more than 10 novels on the Middle East, on terrorism, on radicalization, on the death of Gaddafi, and so on. So a new novel that he wrote called Khalil, on some terrorist attacks in France recently at a soccer stadium. So I'm about 50 pages into that. And it's interesting on the, you know, the insights on what goes on in the minds of suicide bombers in the hours before their attack.
Okay, well, so a series of books that are pretty on point with what's going on and top of mind internationally.
Yeah.
Toma, thanks so much for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed. We'll look forward to having you on again to follow up on this issue.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Our guest today was Toma Junel. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating and comment on iTunes or wherever else you're listening to us. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go out to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.